sit right back, then you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip.
In the year 1831, biologist Charles Darwin began a fateful journey on the HMS Beagle. On that journey, Darwin formulated the controversial theory of evolution, which has impacted society down to this day.
Our goal is to punch holes in that theory, so we'd like to welcome you to
Sink the Beagle.
Fire one, Captain.
Attaboy, John. Excellent shooting.
I have learned from a good person before me. I'm not standing in the presence of greatness of gunners. I'm John Kurlinski.
And you sit in the presence of Stan Hudson, and we want to welcome you to this week's episode of
Sink the Beagle, where we take lighthearted looks and try to get our facts straight and our eyes focused on the serious issues of evolution and creation.
It's an effort to be serious.
It's an effort to be lighthearted, too, sometimes. But we are looking at these last few weeks. We're looking actually a little bit on history.
Because a lot of
evolutionary thought is in history, and a lot of it is interpretive, and that's where we find all the beginnings of all these, not only the origins of our being, of the origins of the earth, the origins found in scripture, but we also look at the origins of ideas and how they develop over time and the flaws or the strengths of the arguments. And today we're going to continue on where we left off a little bit last time, talking a little bit about Hutton, the Moses of scientific thought, that he freed the mind. He was attributed by at least one author as freeing the mind, so to speak,
from the shackles
of religion.
Those constraints.
Those churchmen got us going, twisting us in the
free.
Wind. We're free. We don't have to believe in God anymore. We can go eat, drink, and truly be merry now.
Yes. Well, John, it's good for us to be in the area of history. It's an area that you specialize in because, after all, you lived it.
I lived it. And you, yeah. But I don't look less historical as
you do. Oh, thanks a lot.
There we go.
Well, let's go to England. My grandfather was born in London, so I think I can speak a little bit about England today. 19th century England. We talked recently about James Hutton, and as you mentioned, the Moses, the prophet that led them out. Well, he couldn't have done that successfully if the atmosphere in England were not ready for it, ripe for it. So what's going on in England in the early 19th century is I understand that there's three worldviews talking about how the earth came to be the way it was.
Yeah, so by now there are three views of earth's history that have developed over the time of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the post-Enlightenment is sort of we're almost in. But the first view that was prominent in that day was that of catastrophists.
Okay.
They believe that creation, they were not necessarily biblical here. These are people that believe that there were untold ages and there were major catastrophes that have been involved in the formation of the earth and the things we see out there as we know it. I mean, they would look at something and they'd say a catastrophe happened here to cause this particular geologic formation we're looking at. These catastrophists that were in existence there were not necessarily biblical or believers.
Well, there are some people, significant people, that promoted that view. William Smith, who was an Englishman, and he kind of was the father of English stratigraphy. He was one who produced maps of England and Wales and kind of developed the idea of using fossils to assign certain dates to strata. He was an advocate of a catastrophist theory. And George Cuvier, who was a Frenchman who also popularized the idea of catastrophe. He was not somebody who was bound by the biblical record of talking about a single Noah's flood, but believed there was a number of catastrophic events and that God was involved in a lot of it and created new life forms and so forth after these catastrophes. So they weren't borrowing heavily, if at all, on the biblical account. These were catastrophists, and their view was the world
catastrophe happens.
Catastrophe. That's right.
And a lot of people are like that today, too, in our world. It's kind of funny.
I think I've seen those t-shirts.
Yes, catastrophe happens.
Then another group, of course, is a group that we've talked about a lot, and that's uniformitarianism. The people like
Charles Lyell,
and certainly James Hutton, as we talked about, sort of the father of that thinking, although there were others before and since that have kind of talked about, you know, things are kind of just developing processes.
Yeah, they don't look at the world in realms of catastrophe as much as they were. They almost have an anti-biblical edge to them.
Yes,
what they want to do is really get the realm. There was no Noah's flood. Those were all myths. They accepted the higher critical German schools of interpretation, saying the Bible is myth and stories and folklore, which need to be shed by the modern enlightened age of human reason and human thought.
Right.
And therefore, they developed the idea of uniformitarianism. All things are continuing since the beginning of whatever, whenever, and we're just part of a long, long, long time process.
And many of the scientists today more or less see that, although they've opened the door a little bit to catastrophe here and there, you know, sprinkled throughout time a little bit.
Spurts.
Well, you know, the dinosaurs were wiped out by something, whatever that was. Other extinctions came. And so certain things have happened
through
time.
Meteors or something.
But for the most part, it's pretty much the way it's always been.
And these were especially these two schools were on the rise in the 19th century, late 1800s, late 1700s, early 1900s, and through the times of James Hutton, Charles Darwin. These are formative geologists in the time of what we call formative geology. Geology was not a specific science, but there were people that were writing on it, like the Huttons and the Lyles and stuff, who are starting now to focus on the rocks and on Earth geologic features.
That's right. Often the people that wrote on and studied these things were educated in other areas but had an interest in geology. Like you say, geology was not yet a specific science. Now, over against these two fields that were both challenging the biblical account, let's face it, one hard and one soft challenge to the biblical account, over against these there arose a group that we might almost consider as a reaction or a defense against these rising views, and those are the people that have come to be known as scriptural geologists.
Yeah, there were quite a few authors through that time in Great Britain and throughout Europe. And some in a few even in America, and they were clergymen, not all of them, but often many of them were, but not all of them. But they were also some who were highly trained in science. Others didn't have as much training. They were though competent when they started looking at geology. They could see rocks, they could see things, and they would start writing on them, studying them. They raised biblical philosophical arguments against these other geological ideas that were starting to come forward from the Huttons and the Lyles.
But as they got better educated on the subject, they began to raise scientific questions as well.
And many of them were starting to develop what we call higher degrees, and there's several that we'd even point out that were sort of four fairly good pillars or stalwarts that were fairly competent in the field of geology, and that would be George Young, a George Fairholme, John Murray, and a William Rind. These four gentlemen demonstrated some quality skills in writing about geological.
Well, you know what I like about George Young? He was a minister, a pastor, and for 42 years he was a pastor of a Presbyterian church in Whitby in Yorkshire, England. And, you know, you might ask, of all the things he did, we know that he was very, very a heavy student of foreign languages. He spoke many languages, but he helped found the Whitby Museum and a coastal representative of the Yorkshire Philosophical Society, and that's science back in those days, collecting rock fossil samples. Three of his 21 books and six scientific journals dealt with geology.
How did this minister find the time? Come on, how did he find the time to do all this stuff? He's a minister.
Oh, well, you know, actually, if you think about it, you and I, John, that's how we have time to do Sink the Beagle. We're standing around, sitting around all week long with nothing to do. We only work that one day a week.
Half hour,
part of that one day.
Sure, that's how they get it.
So him, like us, had time on our hands, and, you know.
But he had done a lot of stuff. Another one was that Fairholme guy. He was actually a self-educated landowner, and he traveled extensively throughout Britain and Europe studying not only geology but geography and the fossils and other living creatures. He even wrote two books on geology and several scientific articles, you know, based on all of his works and his studies. He studied the various valley systems of England and Europe and erosion of the
seacoast
in Germany and America, and he led a conclusion. And his conclusion was interesting. He said he concluded that Noah's flood occurred about 5,000 years ago from his day.
Not too far off, and he did that based on his scientific observations.
Studies. Yes, and there were others, too.
We have John Murray, who attained an M.A. and Ph.D. in science, and those are early degrees in science, became well-known, highly regarded throughout Great Britain as a lecturer on physics and chemistry. and he developed quite a knowledge in these areas. He had nearly 20,000 inventions, 20 scientific inventions, which came into practical use. But he had 28 books and 60 articles addressing subjects in all these areas, including geology. And he wrote two books which directly related to geology and the Bible. So he put them together and defended the biblical account based on his studies.
And there's another gentleman named William Ryan, but instead of going into that, Stan, I want to focus a little bit. Really, what does it mean? So what? We have these people. I think it shows two things here.
Okay, what
there
two?
Is some relevance for our day-to-day.
Okay.
Contrary to popular opinion, even among highly trained scientists, scientific facts are not self-interpreting.
Oh, now what do you mean by that?
I mean, these gentlemen, they're
facts.
No, but these gentlemen were looking at the same evidence that the Huttons and the Lyles and others, but they were interpreting them vastly different. In other words, everybody looks at the data. The data is the data. It doesn't tell you anything about it other than it's data.
Yep.
And you and I have to, depending on the philosophical or religious assumptions or glasses that we wear, will interpret it. If you are a believer in the Bible, we have a mutual friend or a colleague. Her name is Elaine Kennedy.
Yes.
She is a geologist, PhD in geology, USC.
From USC.
And she tells us flat out, she's an expert in muds. She's written some mud.
She loves mud
pies. Every little girl. No. The reality is that she knows more about muds than a lot of people ever even dreamed about knowing about mud.
Yes, that's right.
And she writes scientific
journals.
Or would
care to know about
it. But she reads, she says, when I look at the muds, she says, I see the Bible, I see the flood all throughout.
When she looks at the Earth's surface, including muds, she sees catastrophe all over the place.
And she sees it in a biblical proportion. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, one relevant lesson is that data doesn't interpret itself. It needs interpretation.
That's a good point.
Rocks are rocks. And so nothing has changed since the days of the 19th century and these pioneers, both the scriptural and non-scriptural pioneers of geology, they're both looking at data.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what glasses you wear that determine your outcome.
That's exactly right.
Secondly, there's several things that I think are important that we need to look at regarding Genesis, often these rejected the early chapters, these Lyles and the Huttons and others, of Genesis as at best fiction. And the danger comes this way, for this is a biblical slant. When you reject the Genesis 1 to 11 as myth or poetry or literature and take out the historicity of it, the event actually happened, what is to keep you from taking out other supernatural events?
The Bible begins to lose its power, its authority to determining things in your life, and it's going to have a moral decay effect. In Britain, we see that, John. I mean, Darwin is buried in Westminster Abbey. And, we joke about it, I joke about it, as saying, and that's the last time anybody went to church in England is when Darwin went.
Yeah.
You know, Darwin's there and nobody else is, because
the cathedrals are empty.
The cathedrals are empty in England and in Europe. And this is the result of losing a sense of the divineness in the authority of the Bible.
And the relevance of God to our life.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when you look at it that way, why would you believe in a resurrection or any other supernatural event, like an incarnation? Christmas was celebrated recently. We have a torpedo text, Stan, that we like to share with people today.
This is from 1 Timothy 6, in the words of Paul. It says, Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to your care. Turn away from godless chatter and the opposing ideas of what is falsely called knowledge, which some have professed, and in so doing, have wandered from the faith.
Yeah, and sure enough, today we've seen those who've tried to hold fast to faith, found that science and scripture are not in conflict. Mm-hmm. We find it in currently people like Elaine Kennedy and other good scientists, many we talked about a few weeks ago. And you can find it too, as you continue to watch, listen. Maybe someday you can watch it. Or now you have to listen to us on
Sink the Beagle.
Thanks for listening to Sink the Beagle. We'd like to send you a special gift just for being with us today. Write to our email address, beagle@lifetalk.net, and ask for your free copy of Dr. Dwight Nelson's book called Built to Last, A Thoughtful Look at Creation and Evolution. Ask for Built to Last when you write to beagle@lifetalk.net. And be sure to listen in next time for Sink the Beagle.
So join us here each week, my friends. You're sure to get a smile from seven stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Island.